I'm Marty Moscowain. This is Radio Times. I'm sure that a lot of kids, especially young boys, have fantasized that their fathers were spies with lives of intrigue, secret identities, and dangerous missions. Scott Johnson's father was a spy for the CIA, something his dad revealed to him when he was 14 years old. His dad also told him to tell no one, something that gnawed at Johnson as he grew up and worked as a journalist for Newsweek. Scott Johnson has written a memoir about his intense and complicated relationship with his father, and it's titled The Wolf and the Watchman. He also writes about some of the parallels between journalism and espionage and some of the stresses of living a double life. Scott Johnson joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I'd love to have you read the section from the book where you're, it's not the beginning of the book, but where your dad tells you, reveals to you that he's a spy, and you are in a parking lot in Detroit.
Sure. Yeah, we were in a parking lot in Detroit, right? I was 14 years old. "Then, do you know what I do for a living?" I stared at him. I stuttered and began to laugh nervously. The Foreign Service? But even as I spoke, I knew I was wrong. I looked around. We were in a mini mall, sitting in a Buick, and that was our life. He was straightforward, blunt. "Scotty," he said, "I'm a spy." His face twitched. He grinned. I didn't know what to say, so I said what anyone might. "Like James Bond?" But he was nodding already, anticipating me. "Yes," he said, simply. And there it was, that feeling, just a glancing thing in my belly, impunity. As a boy, I had loved those movies in such a proprietary way, Goldfinger and Dr. No and The Spy Who Loved Me. I had wanted him to be like those dashing men, and I imagine he did, too, and that's why he encouraged the connection. The slightly bushy eyebrows that arched up at their corners, the charming wink, the dark Scottish gloom. There was a slight resemblance to Sean Connery. Other people commented on it, he sometimes said, or thought he looked like Clint Eastwood in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, all low-slung and severe, as flat and hard-bitten as some desert butte, except in the eyes which twitched with the glee of ambiguity. "A spy?" I repeated the word a few times, testing it out. "You mean like in the CIA?" But there was no wily Q providing a poison-darted pen, no desert hideaways, bad guys, or shark-infested waters. Nothing even remotely similar. Nothing that I could see anyway. And the Buick seemed like it was beginning to overheat. He nodded and crinkled his brown eyes at me. "Just like that," he said. The clues had been there. The moving, living in strange places, the secrecy, the different jobs he had told me he had had, the various languages he had learned and now forgotten. But whereas before there had only been suspicion, now there was proof. He had released the truth like a genie from a bottle. We sat in the car for a while. A few people strode across the parking lot. It was cold outside and gray, the trees barren. My father looked at me sideways and smiled. I sniggered. He chuckled. Then, like two maniacal idiots, my father and I laughed and laughed. I was near hysterical. My stomach hurt, my eyes watered. On it went until eventually we calmed down, and the laughter came in smaller bursts, faded, and finally subsided altogether. He took out the keys and opened his door. "Come on," he said.
That's Scott C. Johnson reading from his book called The Wolf and the Watchman, A Father, A Son, and the CIA. I so love that paragraph, or the several paragraphs, because it taps into so many emotions. And the fact that you two were just hysterically laughing, I mean, almost like a release, that finally all these little clues began to make sense to a 14-year-old boy.
Yeah, it really was like a release. It was as if, for both of us, I think, a tension had been building for years because neither of us really knew how to deal with this. He, of course, had been grappling with how to tell, you know, me and his family. And I, as you say, had been picking up on these various clues for years. And so there was sort of an unspoken tension, and then suddenly it was just poof, you know, released. And we were, I think we were both struck by that, and it just, you know, the cataclysm of laughter sort of took over us.
But he did, I mean, in a certain way, you were sworn to secrecy as well. I mean, in a way, became a kind of a co-conspirator with your dad.
Yeah, absolutely. And at first, you know, that was really exciting because I thought, geez, you know, I am now in on the big story, as it were, this huge, compelling secret, and that was incredibly exciting. But over time, the reality of that started to sink in, and I realized, well, okay. And he told me, you know, you cannot tell anybody.
Right.
And
that's a big secret for a kid to hold on to.
Yeah, it's a big secret, and it involves lying to your friends and your, you know, sometimes your family, and kind of really, yeah, it's a big deal.
He said to you, or in the book he says to you a number of times, I love you more than the sky. I mean, he seemed to have a very passionate, intense love for you, his son.
Yeah, he did, and he still does. We've always had a really close relationship. I think for him, and I say this in the book at one point, that I think his love for me was the sort of pure thing that he could have in his life, in a life that was already very complicated by sort of moral, psychological, and even physical dangers of one sort or another. And, you know, so having me in his life was just this wonderful thing. And I don't say that in an egotistical way. I think it's just how it was. And I felt the same way.
The same kind of purity that you could love your father so overtly in a way?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's an incredibly affectionate, loving man. And I think that closeness and that sort of intimacy in a way is what oddly generated some of this later discomfort that I had about his line of work and our relationship, because I thought, well, if we are so close and yet at the same time there are these huge portions of his life that are just totally off limits to me, what does that mean for our relationship, and how do both of us understand that?
I mean, kind of omerta in a way, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, like a mafia family.
I mean, I didn't want to go too far on that. But.
Sure, but I think the similarities are there, or really anybody in a line of work where there's a tremendous amount of secrecy and you have to live a double life.
Well, after you have this conversation, he goes into Apex Insurance, into this, which was not, it's really, it was a front for the CIA, and this was in Detroit. What were his other, I guess, cover jobs that he had?
Yeah, so Apex Insurance was the physical address that we had there, or that he had there. And then to different people, we had different cover stories. I mean, at that time, he told people that he worked, I think, for the Commerce Department. He was just a sort of bureaucrat for the Commerce Department. And then at various other postings, you know, he was a consular officer in the embassy or a political officer. For a while, when we lived on a secret base, he was a teacher. So there were a number of different, you know, cover jobs that we had to assume. You know, we had to assume that, like body snatchers.
Well, and for a time in Mexico, he was dean of men at the University of the Americas.
Yeah, that's right. Now, of course, that was before he was recruited into the CIA. That was actually his real job.
A real job.
Yeah, right.
This gets confusing, doesn't it? What's real and what isn't?
Right. So that was his job in 1968. He was a teacher, a professor at the University of Americas. He taught political science. And he was also the dean of men, so he was responsible for sort of student affairs and when they got in trouble or arrested for doing drugs or things like that. And it was in his capacity as dean of men that he became embroiled in this very sort of complex plot at the time to whereby the KGB was trying to infiltrate the university.
And why was he recruited, or how did he get recruited?
So those days in Mexico were really a turbulent time. There was a lot of student protesting going on, and the Cold War was at its apex, of course. And Mexico City was this tremendously important battlefield in that war. And so both the Americans and the Soviets were trying to kind of recruit, you know, one another in sensitive positions. And my father found himself in the middle of a plot that the Soviets had staged to recruit student activists at this university who might be interested in staging protests against the Americans or, you know, things like that. And so what happened is that one of his students kind of got in over his head, and my father saw this happening, and he decided that, well, this wasn't good for the student, but in fact, it might be good for him.
Yes.
So he sort of inserted himself into the equation in a way and found it very enjoyable. And that, of course, led to his connection with the CIA, and then they were very pleased with him and went about recruiting him.
Well, and not to give too much away, later on, there, I guess she was a girlfriend, Sophia.
Yes.
Someone that you knew. And you began to piece together, you know, how much was your dad implicated in some of the things that happened in Mexico at the time?
Yeah, so this was a little bit later in my career. I'd already been a journalist for a while, and I had started this process of questioning of my dad. You know, what had he actually been up to before I was even born? And who was this man? And did I really know him and trust him as I had believed for so much of my life? And then I met this woman in Mexico who had a kind of a similar history in terms of the Omerta that you alluded to earlier. Mm-hmm. Her father, of course, had been on the other side of the equation, and he had been a guerrilla, a sympathizer, a Stalinist with these rebel groups. And the Mexican government had caught him, sent him away to prison for 4 years. And so I started, and it was the exact same year that my father was recruited into the CIA. So I started to think, geez, maybe there's more here. And when I told her about my experience, she was just shattered because it brought up all these traumatic memories in her own life.
And I don't want to give too much away there.
Sure.
But reading your book, I was also thinking about the fact that I think for almost all children, there is something secretive, mysterious, maybe even unknowable about their parents. I mean, yes, you live together in a house, but there are things I think the children probably shouldn't know, and there are often things that children just don't know and they're curious about.
Yeah, I mean, all of us come, I mean, our parents have all had lives before us, for starters, that's one. And then two, there's this a fundamental desire to know, well, where did we come from?
Yeah.
And why did our parents do the things they did, whether it was
career.
Where
do they go during the day?
Yeah, where do they go? Exactly. And I think, you know, in my case, those questions were natural, but then they took on this sort of harder edge because I thought, well, okay, there's the version that everybody else knows, and then there's the version of that, you know, reality that I know.
Especially when you're sort of drawn into his life, both knowing and not knowing, I guess, at the same time.
Yeah, very much.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Scott C. Johnson, and we're talking about his new book. It's a memoir titled The Wolf and the Watchman, subtitled A Father, a Son, and the CIA. He's the son. It's a book about his father's work for the CIA, the secrets they had to keep, and how their relationship has evolved over the many years. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. Questions, comments, give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Penn Museum in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Black Bodies and Propaganda, The Art of the War Poster, opens at the Penn Museum Sunday, June 2nd. Dr. Takufu Zuberi, Penn professor and host of PBS's History Detectives television series, has collected a set of historic posters aimed at mobilizing Africans and African Americans in war efforts, even as they faced oppression at home. Details on the new exhibition and opening day program online at penn.museum.
Hi, I'm Mike McGrath, host of You Bet Your Garden, hoping you'll join us this Saturday morning at 11. We'll slay your slugs, we'll divert your deer, we'll try and help you face off those evil squirrels, and we'll do it all organically. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Hey, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If we were meeting for the first time today on a train, would you find me attractive?
Of course.
Before Midnight is the third film following the relationship of two lovers who met on a train in Vienna in the 1995 film Before Sunrise. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Richard Linklater, and the stars Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. Join us. this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Again, if you're just joining us, or I should say if you're just joining us, Scott Johnson is our guest. We're talking about his new book called The Wolf and the Watchman, and it's about learning at the age of 14 that his dad was a spy for the CIA. They had lived all over the world. He thought his dad was a diplomat, worked for the Foreign Service, and his dad swore him to secrecy about this knowledge that he was a CIA spy. And the book is about the effect of his dad's double life on the family, on Scott Johnson himself, who worked for a number of years as a foreign correspondent for Newsweek, in fact, reported from Iraq and Afghanistan. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Did you out your father in this book? I mean, I know the CIA is very careful about, you know, members of the CIA writing about their lives.
No, I didn't. He had been out for a while. He actually ran a political campaign in the late 90s after he had officially retired from the agency. And once he had retired, of course, he was able to say what he did. But the political campaign brought a lot of that out in a very public way, because he ran as a Democrat, and the Republican Party actually ran a hit campaign, ironically, against him. Because of his affiliation with the CIA.
You lived in a number of places, and one that just seemed so exotic was in New Delhi. I mean, you lived in what sounded like a beautiful, lush environment. There were servants, there were parties. It almost felt like a movie I might have seen from the 1940s.
Yeah, it felt that way. I mean, of course, I was very small at the time, but looking back at pictures and talking through these memories with my parents, you really do get this sense of an old world luxury, sort of a decaying colonialism. It was only, you know, 30 years after partition. So a lot of the infrastructure of the British Empire was still very much there, and diplomats inhabited that world very comfortably. And so that was, you know, that was my early childhood.
And what did your dad, quote unquote, do in New Delhi?
He was a consular officer.
A consular officer, which is a sort of generic cover anything. But he would go to work every day?
Sure, yeah. He would go to sort of two jobs. Sometimes he would pop in and do work as a consular officer to maintain the cover. And then he would carry out his espionage work at other times, both during the normal working hours, but then also off hours at night, you know, going on drives to meet agents or do dead drops. Sometimes he would take my mother along on these excursions. So it was sort of doing double time. And, you know, a lot of the CIA work is kind of a lifestyle in that sense, because you're always on.
Yeah. And parties, I mean, and sort of having to play a role, I guess.
Sure, yeah. In a lot of ways. Absolutely, yeah. You're going to parties, you're everybody you meet is potentially a recruit, somebody who could provide you with valuable information, somebody who could, you know, maybe introduce you to somebody else who could do that. So parties, both at other people's homes and at our home. And of course, this opened the door to all kinds of people coming into our house. And then, as you see in the book, there were, you know, sometimes threats against us.
Yeah, in fact, it looked like you were nearly kidnapped.
Yeah.
There was some very mysterious and a little threatening person that wanted to take you somewhere.
Yes. Yeah. For a while. Have to read the book.
Again, I don't want to give too much away. You mentioned the fact that he would take your mother with him. Was that, do you think, a kind of a cover? I mean, so they would look like a regular American couple.
Oh, for sure. Right. Yeah. It made these excursions all the more normal, you know, just another foreign couple lost in the rickshaw alleys and the wandering nights of India, trying to make their way around. And not just that, I mean, we collectively, the family, my mother, myself, later my stepmother, were all sort of very appropriate covers, and that's how it goes. The more normal you look, the easier it is to fit in.
But do you think, I mean, was there a period where you felt like you're, in hindsight, your dad was using you?
You know, some people ask me that. I suppose in a way you could see it that way. But I never felt used, right. I guess. I never felt used as a tool or something, perhaps because he was so, you know, affectionate and loving to me. I suppose if he had been a really cold, austere, sort of horrible person or something, maybe I would have felt that way. Whether or not he actually did, you know, use us to a certain extent, or whether that's what you do when you're in the CIA. Yeah, maybe.
I mean, your parents divorce. A lot of parents do divorce. Do you think in any way, and perhaps as an adult now, that just the stresses of living this double life worked on their relationship, made it hard for them to be together?
I think that's definitely a factor, sure. I've been told, I don't know this for a fact, but I've been told that the CIA has one of the highest, if not the highest, divorce rates for U.S. government agencies, and I wouldn't be surprised. A lot of people find it very difficult. I mean, maybe it's exciting at first, as it was for me finding out, but over time, it takes a toll. Constantly, you know, assessing people, being on guard, wondering whether, you know, your life is in danger, and the moving, of course, some people find that very, very hard. So, and I think the compartmentalization, too, that was something that really intrigued me as I started to write the book.
And I would also think, so, you know, what is true, what isn't true? I mean, if they're telling me something, is it for my own protection? Is it for their own protection? And trying to navigate, you know, which is which.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I started to think about a lot writing the book was when you're trained your whole life to distrust other people's motives and question the validity of their stories and question even your own assessment of them, all of those skills are really tough kind of psychological exercises. And so I started to wonder, well, if you're trained to be that way all the time for your work, how do you then turn it off at night when you come home? How do you turn it off with your family members? And I don't know that you can, you know. And these were questions that I put to my father. How do you do this? And those conversations really interested me.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from your book on page 225. That's a paragraph. Let me just reintroduce you. And I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. Again, Scott C. Johnson, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book, a memoir called The Wolf and the Watchman, and it's subtitled A Father, a Son, and the CIA. Scott Johnson spent a number of years as a foreign correspondent for Newsweek. In fact, I reported from Afghanistan and Iraq. He's now a freelance journalist. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'd love to have you read this paragraph.
Okay, great. My father was able to contain a huge amount of conflict within himself, more, I think, than most people. It was a tremendous feat. Within the CIA, people like him, who worked as case officers in the clandestine branch, were often referred to as the chosen ones. This was no accident. They had to be particularly skilled at juggling those razor-thin boundaries where identity shifted into mask and back again. They had to understand people more than they understood themselves, anticipate them, think for them, and feel their way into the dark places no one else could. Psychologically, it was a colossal challenge. They were chosen, cultivated, and groomed by masters of manipulation for lives and careers that would require all of their emotional energy. It was no wonder if their resources could only stretch so far.
It's really it's a beautiful and loving passage as you try to understand your father.
Thank you.
And I'm particularly struck by the sentence, they had to understand people more than they understood themselves. It was all sort of outward, right?
Yeah, and this is something that I've often thought about with my father. He is somebody who's very outward-facing generally. He's constantly, and I mean, it's a beautiful thing, really. He's constantly looking at the world and seeing beautiful things. You know, whether we're driving through a field, he'll point out, wow, look at that, you know, wonderful flower or those birds or that ocean or whatever. And it's very touching. And he's similarly very focused toward other people, and very caring. So, you know, an aunt who's ill or a cousin or somebody, you know, he'll always be thinking, well, what's this person going through and what is their experience and what can I do for them? And yet sometimes I wondered whether all of that outward-facing attention came at the expense, perhaps, of some inward reflection about, well, who am I and what are my motivations? And that's not to say he isn't an intelligent, thoughtful person, because he is, but I sometimes wonder whether the focus always has to be sort of outward, because it's a survival question. You need to understand other people first, and then understanding yourself maybe is something else. And yeah. I think, you know, a lot of people can relate to that. Who among us understands ourselves, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Let me get, looks like Jeff from Southampton to join our conversation. Jeff, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Hi, Scott. I'm enjoying the conversation.
Thank you.
I can identify with Scott's experience. I lived in Cyprus, Germany, Beirut, and Tripoli, Hong Kong before I ever moved to the U.S. And it's because my father was in the quote-unquote diplomatic corps.
Wow.
Also.
Wow.
Quite the James Bond lifestyle for him and for me, too, to some extent, because I was 15 when I got to the U.S. My father was in COMO. And,
what is that?
Communications. Communications department, handling the traffic from the field agents, which probably Scott's father may have been one, depending on where they were at the time. It was interesting to learn before my father passed that his first TDY or field op was the Francis Gary Powers Operation Overflight over the Soviet Union that was shot down by Khrushchev.
Yeah, no, I
he was 20 years old, and that was his first field experience. He was in a COMO trailer out there.
Wow.
So I had a different view on life when I moved to the States, and I was wondering if Scott thinks about some of the things that go on and some of the debate in this country today that we have, you know, maybe the drone strikes. I would think he thinks a little differently about it than most people who grew up in this country.
Well, Jeff, I appreciate
with the knowledge that he has.
Sure. I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Yeah, well, yeah, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to meet you, Jeff. And I definitely
feel like a fellow traveler.
Absolutely. It's always such a pleasure to meet people who are, as they say, kind of global nomads, whether their parents worked for the CIA or other agencies. But you know, in terms of current affairs, I certainly have I suppose a different perspective from a lot of Americans, partly informed by what my father did, but also partly because I spent literally all of my journalistic career, except for the last couple of years, overseas reporting from war zones and so on. I mean, I guess depending on the issue, drone strikes, I don't know. I'm still pondering that one. I'm gonna have to hedge, I think, on that one for now.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Let's get Chris from Frankfurt to join us on Radio Times. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a story. I'm growing up in a two-story red brick row house in North Philly. Nothing was very exciting about that, but I had an uncle, my dad's good friend. They grew up together, who was in the CIA. We thought he worked for CARE for a while and other federal agencies, but there's a funny story. He actually showed up at our house one evening, late at night, Uncle Ed. I think it must have been 12 or later. And we came downstairs, my brother and I and my dad. And he asked us to make my dad to make a pot of coffee. He had some coffee. He had us lie down on the living room floor.
Oh my goodness.
And he looked, hugged the wall, looked askance out the front window, and he had a pistol. And then he had his coffee and left the house through the backyard, through the back door. Later on, I think when my dad asked him about all that, he just said, never mind. He didn't want to talk.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
He was a spy. And
yeah.
It wasn't an exotic locale. It wasn't the Caribbean or anything. In fact, he was a kind of middle-aged, out-of-shape guy, at least as I remember him later. But that's the only time that he ever gave us an exciting real spy story.
That's an interesting story, Chris.
No,
thanks for calling into Radio Times. I'm sure there are lots of small stories like that.
Yeah, there are. And it's interesting that he said he was kind of a normal middle-aged looking guy. Mm-hmm. It taps into that trope, I suppose, of, you know, the quiet American, the unnoticed figure that you often see in mm-hmm. John le Carré's books and so yeah. on, that nobody really thinks it amounts to much, but behind the scenes.
Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me read something where you're talking to your dad. I asked him what kinds of qualities were necessary to be a spy. He thought about it for a while. The conversation was a welcome distraction from his pain. And he says, an agent might tell you at length about how he is fighting to preserve the free world, he mused, when in fact what he really wants is a case of whiskey. And to me, I feel like that's what therapy is about. I mean, that's what so many things are about, which is people say one thing, but they really mean something else.
Sure. Yeah, and journalism to a certain extent,
and journalism,
too.
Exactly.
Right. It's about listening, really, more than talking. Or, you know, my father sometimes likens it to being a priest, where you sit down with somebody and they're going through some sort of existential crisis, and you come in at a certain point. And I think a lot of journalists can identify with that too. You know, you fly into a war zone or a refugee camp, or even here in America, I mean, any crisis of any sort, and suddenly you're the first person who has contact with mm-hmm. whoever you're talking to, and you become an important player in their own psychological drama. And I think, to a certain extent, that's what he's talking about.
But do you think you became a journalist because your dad was a spy?
I think subconsciously it definitely played into it. At the time, it just seemed like a really exciting life, and it turned out that it really was.
Yes.
But I just loved I loved the life. I loved the, you know, telling stories and traveling and just being in the midst of this. As they say, the first draft of history, it was incredibly intoxicating. But at a deeper level, and I came to realize this over time, there was this really powerful force at work, which was a desire to tell the truth about things, because so much of my childhood had been about keeping secrets and keeping the truth at bay and not letting other people in to my secret. So the possibility that there was a life where that was encouraged and validated, that was really tremendous.
We're almost up on a break here, but you were in Iraq in the real thick of the civil war then. Was it also, was there something about danger?
Yeah, I think there was. My childhood wasn't particularly dangerous, but I got a taste of all kinds of things that I suppose a lot of kids don't. My dad used to take me up, for instance, in Pakistan to the Northwest Frontier Province, which is sort of a no-go zone these days. But at the time, it was Afghan refugees were streaming over. And so those images were seared into my mind. And I think as an adult, I sought them out actively.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation again. Scott C. Johnson, our guest today on the show. The book is called The Wolf and the Watchman, A Father, a Son, and the CIA. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You decide the winners at WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs, June 20th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Food fanatics will love this two-hour tasting, featuring an array of mouth-watering munchies served up by local restaurants and businesses, all competing to be named 2013's Best of the Chefs, with summer beer garden, specialty cocktails, and live music. WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs. Tickets at whyy.org/events.
Fast food workers have been striking in cities across the country, but now some critics are asking, why should workers have it their way?
You shook my hand, looked me in the eye, and said, I will do this job for X, and then you come back the next day and complain about it. Why would I ever want to work with you again? You're a liar.
We'll have a lively debate over the fast food strikes. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. An update on allegations of chemical weapons use in Syria. And Radiolab's Robert Krulwich wonders why men stop buying clothes at the age of 50. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Scott Johnson. He was 14 years old when his dad stopped his car in a parking lot, told his son that he was a CIA spy. Johnson had believed that his dad was actually a diplomat and worked for the Foreign Service. They had lived in many places, including India, Yugoslavia, Pakistan. His dad told him to keep that knowledge a secret, which festered over the years. Scott Johnson worked as a journalist for Newsweek, in fact, was a war correspondent in Afghanistan and Iraq. His book is about the effect his dad's double life, the duplicity, had on the family, and it's titled The Wolf and the Watchman, A Father, A Son, and the CIA. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You write in your book that at some point you began hearing voices, but as you say, you know, you weren't hearing strange people's voices. In a sense, you were hearing your own voice. Do you think it was sort of part of this conversation you were having with yourself to try to figure out who your dad was, what was real, what wasn't?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the sort of things that you engage in, I guess, as a kid doing this is that there's a lot of meticulousness. And you have to be careful about what you say and to whom you say it, how you say it even. And so that meticulousness about presentation kind of crept into my mind. And I'm not saying it was all due to my father's job, but I think maybe some of it was. And also it was sort of tinged with a moral tone. You know, am I a good person? Am I a bad person? Who am I? Where do I fit in? And so when I talk about this voice, it was sort of a very powerful inner critic, I suppose, to use a therapeutic term. And that was something that really bothered me for many, many years. And it took a lot of thinking and writing and so on to excise it, I suppose. But I suppose some of it goes back to my childhood.
Well, in fact, you did see a psychiatrist. Many people have seen psychiatrists. There's absolutely no shame in that. He told me I was having borderline dissociation.
Yeah, so this was after I returned from my first major stint in Iraq, which was about a 7-month period during the invasion. It was a time I had a very, very close scrape with death, actually. I had been ambushed, and then I proceeded to stay there and report for 7 months, and I returned from that just really kind of a wreck. And that was when I saw the psychiatrist, and so I was having kind of PTSD issues, but combined with this very powerful, you know, inner critic voice, and it kind of led to a breakdown of sorts, and so he told me that.
Was that helpful? I mean, was it helpful to say there was a diagnosis, I guess?
It was and it wasn't. I mean, it was in the sense that somebody else was validating that I, you know, that I was in a bad place, but I didn't agree with the diagnosis, so I chose to sort of take my own view and my own path, and I continued to get different kinds of therapy. He advocated going on a kind of a medication that I didn't want to do, and so I just pursued other avenues, which turned out to be the correct ones.
Well, I can only imagine. I mean, you know, I work in this hermetically sealed room here. I've never, as I said before on the show, I've never risked my life for a story. But you were in Iraq during the real height of the civil war, the sectarian violence that was just exploding in certain parts of that country.
Yeah, so I was a bureau chief for Newsweek there in 2005 and 2006, which were the height of the troubles. There were killings, massacres every day. It was an incredibly risky time, and I salute any other journalist who was there at that time. It was a really tough time. And, you know, so I lived there for 2 years, reporting on the, you know, the disintegration of that country.
And sort of living it and reporting on it and experiencing it as well, right?
Yeah.
And you just have to be in this constant state of alertness.
Oh, absolutely. And, what, you know, one of the interesting things, and I think other correspondents can certainly relate to this, is that when you're in the midst of something like that, it's so intense. and so all-consuming, literally. It's day and night. You know, you're working 24 hours a day, really, except for when you're sleeping, but all the time. And you always sort of feel for your life. We would have mortars and rockets come in and land, you know, very close to our house. Going out into the streets was sometimes very dangerous. And so, you know, when you're there, you're thinking, okay, as soon as I get out of here, everything's going to be fine and I'm going to return to normal. But in fact, it's just the opposite, because as soon as you get out, your defenses start to come down, and then all of that kind of built-up trauma and tension starts to overwhelm you. And veterans of the military and also journalists will tell you the exact same thing. It's always when you are out, when you return, that the trauma of the whole experience starts to sort of wash over you.
Did your dad worry about you?
He did. He worried about me, of course, when I was there. We would have long conversations about it. He was, you know, he was proud and happy that I was doing something that I enjoyed doing, but he was tremendously worried. And of course, when I got out, you know, he would, he wondered, you know, whether I had PTSD and so on. Mm. At that time, PTSD was still kind of emerging into the public consciousness. Now we know a lot more about it.
He, as you write, would feed you stories as well. I mean, give you ideas for stories.
Yeah, he would, because he was really well versed in foreign affairs and the history of these different places. And he would, you know, he would say, hey, you know, why don't you look into this or ask me questions? What's happening here? And he knew all the intricacies. You know, what are the Sunnis doing? And what does this faction say? And what about this particular politician? He followed it like a hawk.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of journalists have been accused of being spies for the CIA, right?
Sure. When I was in Afghanistan, I myself was often accused of being a spy for the CIA, because with a friend, we would roam around. This was back in 2001. We would roam around the country, driving here and there, all around the country. And at that time, there were these CIA outposts throughout the country and special operations posts, and those guys were also doing the same thing. And we kept hearing reports that there were these, you know, unnamed, unidentifiable, quote-unquote journalists who would show up to a local governor's house or, you know, a particular politician's or a warlord's house and say, you know, let's talk. Mm. And then we would show up later and say, well, who was that journalist? And it wasn't anybody we knew.
Did your fellow journalists know that your dad had worked for the CIA?
No, that was something that I kept on, as they say, the down low. I didn't really.
It's another use of that word, but yes,
yes.
Go ahead.
I really didn't want to advertise that widely or publicly at all. Both for my own credibility, I didn't want to be seen as a journalist who had somehow, you know, connections.
Baggage, maybe.
Baggage, even. Yeah, and dubious connections. I thought it would harm my own reputation, and perhaps it would have. And I also I was aware because of my own childhood that if I came out with something like that, people around me could also be affected, as my father had taught me. So my translators, my fixers, even my other colleagues, it might place them in an uncomfortable position, and I didn't want to do that.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Ed from Westchester to join us. And Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Hi,
there.
Scott. Great.
Hi there.
Great piece. Really enjoying it.
Thank you.
Scott, I wanted to ask you, I have a son, he's 10, and you spoke in your book about the clues that came along, and my son, he doesn't miss a trick, and he's in my office, he's always
We're losing your phone line. If you want to give us a call back, I'm sorry, it just kind of broke up on us as you were calling in to Radio Times. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That happens with cell phones sometimes. Scott Johnson, our guest, and the book is called The Wolf and the Watchman, A Father, A Son, and the CIA. Again, I hope I'm not giving too much away, but towards the end of the book, you... I guess have a relationship, would that be the right word, with a insurgent, a person you call Abu Ahmed?
Yeah, I got to know this guy. I had returned to Iraq in 2008 after a period of being away, a hiatus. Mm. And I had gone there with the specific intent of trying to understand the insurgency. What had created it? Who was behind it? And how did it really become the thing that it became, this incredibly violent storm? And so I started looking for people who had been there from the beginning. And through a series of connections, I wound up finding this guy who had played a really pivotal role in the development of the insurgency. And then later, he actually turned on the insurgency because of something that his own personal story. And he went and he became a player for the CIA. And this guy just fascinated me. I wanted to know, of course, what he had done and who he was, but I also wanted to know, you know, what was it like for him to work with people like my father? And I was just fascinated by this idea that maybe I can find out something about my father through this guy.
Well, let me quote what he says. And again, I hope I'm not, you know, stealing your thunder here. And he says to you, they're very about his handlers, I guess, people in the CIA that he worked for, not necessarily your dad. But he says they're very respectful and understanding, very smart. They know about our heritage, our culture, and our behavior. They have talents and curiosity.
Yeah, and when he said that, I thought, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense.
Does it sound like your dad?
That's my dad, yeah, and that's other people that I've known in the agency over the years. You know, of course, we always think of the CIA in these mythological Hollywood-esque terms, that this is, you know, this is an agency that's been up to all sorts of no good. And of course, there's definitely truth to that.
Sure.
But at the same time, it's made up of people. And a lot of these people are really extraordinary people, kind and thoughtful and interesting and intelligent and with a lot of care and devotion. And I've known those people in all kinds of different contexts. And so to hear that from this guy who had grown up under Saddam Hussein, been in prison, been through all kinds of mayhem, to see him kind of coming out of that world and interacting with my world in this slow transition was really powerful for me.
Well, and he also seemed to really love his dad as well.
Yes, yeah, he did. And his own relationship with his father was the catalyst for his kind of conversion. And that was all, that also really spoke to me.
Let me get Lynn from Princeton to join our conversation. And Lynn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to ask what sorts of conversations you'd had with your father about the role of the CIA and you know, the fact that it's been known to do things like assassinate elected leaders and such things. And also, if you feel that being in the CIA had any negative consequences for your father's own morality, because as a lawyer, I'm in a profession where people can, if they choose, lie quite a bit. Some people think there's an ethical obligation to do so. But I've become really aware that it's not possible to lie all day and, you know, have your morality be unaffected at night.
That's a good question. Thanks, Lynn, for the call. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for the two questions. The first one, you know, the short answer is yes. I had all kinds of conversations with my father, starting way back in high school and college when I started to pester him about what had the CIA been up to in Central America and South America to start with. And, you know, so we had an ongoing conversation about those things. And a lot of it, I think, you know, he sort of approached it from this idea that, well, there was a larger issue, right? The Cold War. And he saw it through that lens. He was a cold warrior. So, you know, my own protestations about the morally hazardous area were always kind of put into that context. Well, this was the Cold War and the Soviet Union was up to all kinds of no good and we had a duty and an obligation to counter them. That's actually what he said. Yeah. And then later, you know, these conversations took a different turn after September 11th and the so-called war on terror and so on, when allegations started coming out about torture and prisons and things. He was bothered by that, as I think a lot of people in the CIA were. And I think, obviously, many of the rest of us were as well. And so we had conversations about that too. You know, who was doing this, and what did it mean for the agency? What did it mean for our country? There's a point in the book where I say, you know, I think a lot of these questions were leading him to not, you know, they were sort of leading him to kind of doubt or question what was happening to his country. And I think a lot of us went through that same process. You know, who are we? What's happening to our country? And that's a, you know, I was happy to see that it was having that effect on him. And then that kind of gets into the second question that you had about lying and how do you stay a moral person? He has tried very hard to do that. But as I said earlier, I think that there's always going to be a little bit of, you know, as they say, mission creep, where your professional obligations and development and training are going to creep into your life. I had those questions about him, and if you read the book, you'll see that you know, I wondered myself, had he been up to no good? Had he done bad things? And I was, well, you'll have to see what happens in the book.
Let's leave it there, but we're almost out of time here, but you know, being a good liar, there's a power, but there's a price, don't you think?
Yes, there is. And, you know, I think one of the other things to think about is when you are in a profession that, as the caller said, gives you permission to lie, encourages you to lie, you almost have to be that much more vigilant to understand the boundaries of where it's acceptable and where it's not, whether it's in your professional life or in your personal life.
Well, Scott Johnson, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Wolf and the Watchman, A Father, A Son, and the CIA. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, our engineer, and Emily Bryant helping us out this week. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.